Hi, you're listening to Mike Loughran on the Management Perspectives podcast. Please follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter, where I publish all of my podcasts and blogs. Hi, my name is Mike Loughran, and this is the Management Perspectives podcast. In this show, we're going to be discussing the uncomfortable topic of cyber attacks. We'd all like to live in blissful ignorance of the threats that are out there, but unfortunately, we're seeing more and more high-profile attacks, especially in the industrial sector. To discuss what leaders can do to protect their assets and employees, I'm delighted to be joined by Eduardo Di Monter, who is a Rockwell Automation Cybersecurity Portfolio Strategic Growth Leader, and Grant Geyer. He's the Chief Product Officer at industrial cybersecurity company called Clarity. Would you like to introduce yourselves to the listeners, guys?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Hi, Mike. So my name is Eduardo Di Monte. I work in Rockwell, as you said. I also spent some time working as a CISO for almost 8 years, also as a consultant, and then as an entrepreneur. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, hi, I'm Grant Geyer, Chief Product Officer at Clarity. I've been building cyber products for the past 25 years at startups, at-scale companies, in a variety of different focus areas within cybersecurity. What really has been personally meaningful to me is the area of operational technology security that we focused on at Clarity, because what's happening is that what the attacks in the cyber world can now impact what's happening in the physical world. And my responsibility at Clarity is to focus on the product management, engineering, and research teams to ensure that we're building the right products to help companies defend themselves.
Many thanks, guys. Great intro. To kick us off, I think mentioned companies such as Colonial Pipeline, JBS, both very well established and reputable names in the industrial space. And an immediate association sometimes is cyber attack, which is strange because, neither one of them is producing cyber attacks, but that's what's associated. And if organizations like those can fall victim to an attack, then no business is off the table. And if it wasn't already obvious to the sector's leaders, these global headlines have pressed the issue and emphasized now, more than ever, I think it's time to take a look at cybersecurity and take it seriously in the industrial world. So to kick us off with that, I'd like to ask you both, what reverberations do you think incidents like these have had on the sector? Eduardo, do you want to start?
Yeah. I think cyber is a priority right now, and it's not something that we need to leave behind. But basically, the main issue, as Grant said too, that now physical, there's a physical impact now. So cyber attacks can generate a physical impact on people and on companies because there's a high level of dependency on the digital assets, right? So cyber criminals are trying to target this type of companies where they're going to have a disruptive. So it's gonna be an impact on the physical. Also, of course, there's a ransom payment, right? In this case, as you said, started with a problem on the pipes, and then end up paying more than $4 million of dollars. So.
Yeah, I'll take it from there, Eduardo. Just to add to those points. What's clear is that every industrial organization in the world is trying to obtain an advantage from digital transformation. Now, that could be predictive maintenance, just-in-time ordering systems, big data analytics in order to analyze inventory and analyze the work of their supply chains. While there's so many competitive advantages that can be gained and efficiencies that can be driven from the connection of digital technology, the soft underbelly of that digital transformation is digital risk. And so these plants, which contain a lot of assets, programmable logic controllers and SCADA systems that were never secured by design, are now being connected into the IT network and up to the cloud. And that's providing attackers an opportunity to compromise and cause damage to the physical world. And we have to look no further than we're now at the 1-year anniversary of the Colonial Pipeline attack. And this is an example where the attackers weren't actually going after the OT systems, but because of the connectivity, the Colonial Pipeline security team couldn't positively state that the attack against the IT systems didn't make its way into the OT systems. And I think what's different now is I think for the first time, society was impacted in a very serious way. So it should be no surprise that the governments of the world are getting involved. The White House recently held a meeting of, I think, over 40 countries to discuss, to work collaboratively on ransomware. And so there's a whole of government approach to focus on ransomware. There's a number of directives that have been put in place to help spur critical infrastructure into making improvements. There have been 3 sprints announced by the White House across the pipeline, water, and electric sector. And, you know, the implication when you're sprinting, it doesn't suggest that things are going well, right? I think it demonstrates that there's a significant gap between these risk cyber postures, which are, you know, tremendously exposed, and the risk to society that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that IT-OT convergence is having an impact. The fallout of one soon goes into the other. It's really scary, as you both point out. You know, there is massive rewards for nefarious activities. So people will dedicate their time and resource to execute an attack. I'm interested to understand, how selective are they? And, you know, do they go specific targets or do they scatter approach?
No, I think that they're not selective and very specific. It's more general, right? But at the end, imagine a cyber attack can launch thousands of attacks at the same time. So what they're looking is after vulnerabilities, the weakest point in the organizations, and they want to cause the most damage, right? And of course, gain money out of that. So I would say that it's not very selective, but everybody can be a victim, you know, because they're so easy to launch. And at the end, they're looking for the weakest point, and that's what they're looking for, yeah.
And, you know, I'll give maybe a little bit more nuanced answer. And I think that Eduardo is correct that there's a lot of what I'll call spray and pray ransomware out there where, you know, if you happen to be, you know, the car that gets broken into is the one that leaves its doors where the owners leave the door unlocked and they leave the keys in the ignition. And that certainly covers a broad class of the targets. I would just say, in addition to that, there has been some, you know, more selective targeting than I've seen. And it's over the past several months. Just a couple of quick examples here. There is an attack that was conducted a couple of years ago against an automobile manufacturer, where the attackers specifically were looking to understand the HMIs and controllers that were used in that environment as part of their ransomware attack, and they wanted to put ransomware on the HMIs.
Yeah, so not just is it a spray and pay and a scatter approach, it's also selective. It just broadens out the risk that's out there, right? Perhaps if it was more targeted, we could do more about it. I'm Mike Loughran, and you're listening to the Management Perspectives podcast. Today I'm speaking with Grant Geyer, Chief Product Officer at Clarity, and Eduardo De Monte, Cybersecurity Portfolio Strategic Growth Leader at Rockwell Automation, and we're discussing the most common cyber threats in the industrial environment. I think everyone's aware of people talking about, well, you know, people using the same passwords and leaving things about, and that sounds quite obvious, but what other common attack vectors are there?
Yes, I mean, of course, you got the password vulnerability. That's an issue, but that's not the only one. Also, there's now with COVID, for example, that everybody's working remote. Now we have this secure remote access that, of course, now became a huge problem. Then, of course, there are many other organizations. They don't have resources to start. But at the end, I think there's so many ways to get into a company, right? That it's important to have a risk analysis and, of course, to have visibility. I think those are the main topics, right? You need to understand what are your critical assets, where are located, and what is the level of risk you have on those assets. And of course, the dependency that your core business has towards those assets. And then after that, you need to start doing the investments, the appropriate investments, yeah.
Yeah, I think that Eduardo is precisely correct. Look, attackers, if I were to break down attack methodologies, it's going to come in two different classes. There are going to be asset-based attacks, in which an attacker is trying to figure out a chink in the armor that they can expose or a vulnerability that they can exploit to get into the environment. In addition to asset-based attacks, there's also identity-based attacks, where I'm going to pretend to be someone who's an operator of the plant and get their credentials and try to break in and walk right through the front door. And if I can do that, I don't need to find a weakness. And so, you know, I think that's kind of what we're up against is, again, these asset-based attacks and identity-based attacks. And that's really where our focus needs to be for protection. It really comes down to limiting and defending the attack surface area. And so I completely agree with Eduardo here that on the asset-based attacks, it's understanding the assets, understanding what's exposed, understanding the connectivity between the IT and OT environment. And like part of the challenge of industrial controlled environments is that a lot of assets may be out of support from the vendors and can no longer be patched. There are cases where, yes, you can patch, but a patching window may not be available for 3 months or 6 months. And so the key is to understand what is the exposure and what compensating controls you can have in place. On identity-based attacks, it's really straightforward that it's critical, especially in the time of COVID when people are remote, to having strong remote access in place, multi-factor authentication, so that you can verify that people are who they claim to be. You can limit access to only the assets that they need access to, and there was a lot of third-party automation vendors who need access. And also you can limit when, as part of management change, you're limiting when they can get access to those assets. So I think there's a very set of straightforward techniques that organizations can do at both. Part of the challenge that I see is a lot of the government recommendation of late has in these 100-day sprints have been on monitoring. And the problem with monitoring is that I think of it as a, you know, university graduate level course. When many of the public utilities are very small, undermanned organizations, and they're more kind of at the elementary school level of education, and we're trying to give them a graduate level. So I think there's a bit of a mismatch there. But I really think it's about focusing on the basics.
Yeah, because you both touched on a couple of points there that I was actually going to ask for a little bit more detail on, but I think it's worth the listeners. Me asking the question, you know, you mentioned the COVID aspect of things, which drove a lot more remote working. That there's also been the what we've seen over the last couple of years is labor shortages, which have actually driven up the amount of remote support that customers are looking for, that industry is looking for. And that remote support isn't just from their own employees, but from supply chain, third-party vendors. And does that complicate matters, or can you apply those same basics you've just mentioned, Grant, across both supply chain and the company itself in a remote working environment, which we're seeing more and more of due to, well, COVID, lack of labor, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, look, I worked as a chief product officer at a company that had identity solutions in the past. And the interesting thing that happened with COVID, you know, every company in the world maybe went from 25% or 50% of remote workers to 100% overnight. And a lot of organizations have been scrambling to put in some type of zero trust mechanisms to help ensure that they could secure the identities of their workforce not surprisingly, a lot of asset intensive organizations take longer to put in new sets of tools like this, making matters more complex. There's a lot of third party automation vendors that sometimes may have access directly into the plants. And so one of the key things that I think organizations need to do is not only put multi-factor authentication in place, but really have a policy that forces everyone in the company and everyone that's contracted to the party, to the company, to go in through the same VPN, to use the same mechanisms to get into the plant. Otherwise, it can be the Wild West in a pretty lethal attack environment out there. I mean, if you look at what happened in the attack against the Oldsmar water utility plant and another water utility plant a few weeks earlier, is they used old credentials to get to literally walk right through the front door and try to change levels of lie within the water supply.
Yeah, I fully agree what you said. And also we need to take in consideration that if we have suppliers that are working for us, it applies exactly the same, right? Because if they have a risk and they have weak passwords, for example, then through them can access to the organization. And we had an incident several years ago here in Spain related to that one service company that was giving service to the top 20 companies here in Spain had an issue, and then all their customers, those 20 huge companies, also had an incident too. So I fully agree with Grant's idea and strategy. Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the classic example where we started there. There's the asset attacks and there's the identity attacks. And, you know, if you attack the identity, can you just then bypass everything else? Or are there other ways people can put in layers of cybersecurity? So if one gets circumvented, there's other ways to do it. You know, what's the approach on that?
I think it takes having multiple layers of defense to protect an environment. That starts with understanding what your attack surface area looks like from the outside, limiting the exposures that can exist. If hackers do find a way into the environment, ensuring that there are monitoring capabilities that are multifaceted in nature. So if an attacker can sidestep one or two methods, they can't sidestep the third and fourth methods of attack. But I think it does require having a multiple layers of defense. My recommendation, and I think Eduardo touched on this earlier, is really having a security risk assessment completed to understand what the lay of the land looks like and what, you know, how an attacker would typically get in. The NIST Cybersecurity Framework, or CSF, is a great blueprint for organizations to kind of understand where they are now and chart their path about where they want to be in the future. It's impossible to go from, you know, 0 to 100 within days or weeks, but you can make significant gains by doing a risk assessment and following in the CSF, be very purposeful about the controls you need to put in place.
I agree with Grant. I'm a big fan of NIST, not because of anything special, but I really like the way it's explained at the end. In order to minimize the threat, the idea is that you put different layers or activities or projects into these five major activities. One is identify, in other words, protect, detect, response, and recovery. And if you think, if you invest a lot of effort on identify but nothing in protect, then at the end, you're still gonna have a problem. If you invest a lot in protection but nothing in detection, when something happens, you're not gonna be able to see it, right? And applies the same to response and recovery. So I think the issue here is first having this risk assessment, understanding what are the major projects or cybersecurity layers or activities that were missing in these five, and then doing the right investments in these five pillars, I think, right? And of course, another major issue here is time. If it's gonna take you 5 years to do it, then those 5 years, the risk is going to be there, right? So it's also a time issue problem, yeah.
The attack vectors are widening, the type of attacks are widening, but the good news is that there are some very key points that people can follow, whether that be looking at NIST or engaging various different companies to help them out with that, to help them address this. And by the sounds of it, there are many ways we can do this, but it does need to be thought about, and people can't ignore it and hope it won't hit them, because it's going to hit them. It's going to be kind of when, not if. So that is good news to me and the listeners, I think. But hey guys, if I had to give you some final words, what advice would you give to the listeners who've thought themselves, right, I need to take some action now? What would you say? What would be your words of wisdom?
So I'll just add, in terms of the points that have been made earlier, the human element is really critical here. And if the same way that we as IT users, we have as users in our company have been taught, look for suspicious emails, don't click on links if you don't know who they're from, don't open strange attachments. What our companies are in essence trying to do is make we as IT users the first line of defense in cybersecurity. Now, the second line of defense is the SOC, it's the risk and compliance teams, and the third line of defense is internal audit. And I think for business leaders, taking the same three lines of defense model and applying it to the industrial cybersecurity problem is key. And what that means is that process engineers should be the first line of defense. They know the equipment, they know the environment, they know operating conditions. In the same way, kind of a beat cop can notice strange ongoings from the norm in a neighborhood, that's what we want to train the first line of defense, the process engineers, to do. And if you look about what happened in the Oldsmar situation, it was an operator that saw strange activity going on his screen that called it out. And so educating, training, awareness for the first line of defense, it's industrial enterprises, is key. Second is making sure that the second line of defense, your security team, acts as a backstop to the first line of defense, and giving them purview not just over what's happening in the IT environment, but a single view over IT and OT. And if organizations are large enough to have a third line of defense, that's always good for checks and balances. But again, the human element is key, because the attack surface area is expanding enough, attack techniques are becoming more and more complex. You won't be able to stop everything, but hopefully having that first line will help ensure that the organization can spot a lot of these challenges before they become serious.
Yeah, I think that the only thing I can add to that is also it's good to reduce the attack surface area, right? I know it's complicated because the adoption of different technologies adds more devices, right? But the we need to try to reduce that surface area. That would be one thing. Of course, people, it's another important. And then I would add that it's also important to test your organization's, you know, business continuity plans. At the end, at some point, we might have an incident, so we need to be ready, and it needs to be tested, and things cannot be improvised. Yeah.
Fantastic. Eduardo, Grant, thank you very much for your time. And listeners, thank you for your attention. You've been listening to the Management Perspectives podcast. Please follow me, Mike Loughran, on LinkedIn and Twitter, where I publish all of my podcasts and blogs. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review us, as this really helps the show.